His body grew smaller. I was standing there looking at myself. Then the mirror image disappeared, and I was alone. Startled, I took a step backward and slipped. I fell, tumbling over and over. In my mind's eye, I saw the terrible hooded specter waiting expectantly below. I heard Sock's voice, yelling from somewhere above. 10th floor, lingerie, bedspreads, 8th floor, housewares, cameras. I was lying on the office couch, looking up into Sock's gentle smile. Well, he said, are you going to kill yourself? No. But with that decision, the weight and responsibility of my life once again fell upon me. I told him how I felt. Socrates grasped my shoulders and only said, stay with it, Dan. Before I left that night, I asked him, where is Joy? I want to see her again. In good time. She'll come to you, later perhaps. But if I could only talk to her, it would make things so much easier. Whoever told you it would be easy? Socrates, I said, I have to see her. You don't have to do anything except to stop seeing the world from the viewpoint of your own personal cravings. Loosen up. When you lose your mind, you'll come to your senses. Until then, however, I want you to continue to observe as much as possible the debris of your mind. If I could just call her. Get to it, he said. In the following weeks, the noise in my mind reigned supreme. Wild, random, stupid thoughts, guilts, anxieties, cravings, noise. Even in sleep, the deafening soundtrack of my dreams assaulted my ears. Socrates had been right all along. I was in prison. It was a Tuesday night when I ran to the station at 10 o'clock, bursting into the office. I moaned, Socrates, I'm going to go mad if I can't turn down the noise. My mind is wild. It's everything you told me. Very good, he said, the first realization of a warrior. If this is progress, I want to regress. Dan, when you get on a wild horse that you believe is tame, what happens? It throws you, or kicks your teeth in. Life has, in its own amusing way, kicked your teeth in many times. I couldn't deny it. But when you know the horse is wild, you can deal with it appropriately. I think I understand, Socrates. Don't you mean you understand you think? He smiled. I left with instructions to let my realization stabilize for a few more days. I did my best. My awareness had grown these past few months, but I entered the office with the same questions. Socrates, I finally realized the extent of my mental noise. My horse is wild, now how can I tame it? How do I turn down the noise? What can I do? He scratched his head. Well, I guess you're just going to have to develop a very good sense of humor. He bellowed with laughter, then yawned and stretched, not the way most people usually do, with arms extended out to the side, but just like a cat. He rounded his back, and I heard his spine go crack, 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 crack. Socrates, did you know that you look just like a cat when you stretched? I suppose I do, he replied nonchalantly. It's a good practice to copy the positive traits of various animals, just as we might imitate positive qualities of some humans. I happen to admire the cat. It moves like a warrior. And as it happens, you have modeled yourself after the jackass. It's time you started to expand your repertoire, don't you think? Yes, I suppose it is, I answered calmly. I excused myself and went home early, just after midnight, and slept for 5 hours before my alarm woke me, and I doubled back toward the station. At that moment, I had made a secret resolution. No more playing victim, someone he could feel superior to. I was going to be the hunter. I was going to stalk him. It was still an hour until dawn when his shift would end. I hid in the bushes that lined the bottom edge of campus near the station. I would follow him and somehow find Joy. Peering through the foliage, I watched his every move. My thoughts quieted in the intensity of my vigil. My sole desire was to find out about his life away from the station, a subject about which he'd always been silent. Now I'd track down the answers myself. Like an owl, I stared at him. I saw as never before how smooth, how graceful he was. He washed windows without a wasted movement, slipped the nozzle into the gas tank like an artist. Socrates went into the garage, probably to work on a car. I grew weary. The sky was already light when I roused myself from what must have been a few minutes of shut-eye. Oh, no, I'd missed him. Then I saw him, busy with his last-minute duties. My heart constricted as he walked out of the station, crossed the street, and headed directly toward where I sat, stiff, shivery, and achy, but well hidden. I just hoped it didn't feel like beating around the bush this morning. I faded back into the foliage and calmed my breathing. A pair of sandals glided past, no more than 4 feet from my temporary lair. I could barely hear his soft footsteps. He followed a path that forked right. Quickly but cautiously, I scampered along the path like a squirrel. Socrates walked at a surprising clip. I barely kept up with his long strides and nearly lost him, when, far ahead, I saw a head of white hair entering Doe Library. What, I thought, could he be doing there, of all places? Tingling with excitement, I closed in. Once past the large oak door, I cut past a group of early bird students who turned and laughed, watching me. I ignored them as I tracked my prey down a long corridor. I saw him turn right and disappear. I sprinted to where he had disappeared. There could be no mistake. He had entered this door. It was the men's room, and there was no other exit. I didn't dare go in. I stationed myself in a nearby phone booth. 10 minutes passed. 20 minutes. Could I have missed him? My bladder was sending out emergency signals. I had to go in. Not only to find Socrates, but to make use of the facilities. And why not? This was my domain, after all, not his. I could make him explain. Still, it would be awkward. Entering the tiled bathroom, I saw no one at first. After finishing my own business, I started to search more carefully. There was no other door, so we still had to be there. One guy came out of a stall and saw me hunched over looking under the stalls. He hurried out the door with wrinkled brow, shaking his head. Back to the business at hand. I ducked my head for a quick look under the last stall. First I saw the backs of a pair of sandal feet. Then suddenly Sock's face dropped into view, upside down with a lopsided grin. He obviously had his back to the door and was bending forward, his head down between his knees. I stumbled backward in shock, completely disoriented. I had no good reason for my bizarre bathroom behavior. Socrates swung the stall door open and finished with a flourish. Woo-wee! A man can get constipated when he's being stalked by a junior warrior. As his laughter thundered through the tiled room, I reddened. He had done it again. I could almost feel my ears lengthen as I was once again transformed into a jackass. My body churned with a mixture of shame and anger. I could feel my face turn red. I glanced at the mirror, and there, tied neatly in my hair, was a perky yellow ribbon. Things began to make sense. The people's smiles and laughter as they'd walked through campus. The strange looks I'd gotten from my fellow bathroom occupant. Socrates must have pinned it to my head while I dozed off in the bushes. Suddenly very tired, I turned and walked out the door. Just before it swung shut, I heard Socrates say, not without a tone of sympathy in his voice, "That was just to remind you who is the teacher and who is the student." That afternoon, I trained like the unleashed furies of hell. I talked to no one, and wisely no one said a word to me. I quietly raged and swore I'd do whatever was necessary to make Socrates acknowledge me as a warrior. One of my teammates stopped me on the way out and handed me an envelope. "Someone left this in the coach's office. It's addressed to you, Dan. A fan of yours?" "I don't know. Thanks, Herb." I stepped outside the door and ripped open the envelope. On an unlined piece of paper was written, "Anger is stronger than fear, stronger than sorrow. Your spirit is growing. You are ready for the sword. Socrates." Chapter 3. Cutting Free. The next morning, I decided to relax before tackling my daily activities. So I pulled out my small TV and dumped some cookies into a bowl. Switching on a soap opera, I immersed myself in someone else's problems. As I watched, mesmerized by the drama, I reached for another cookie and discovered that the bowl was empty. Could I have eaten all those cookies? Later that morning, I went running around Edwards Field. There I met Dwight, who worked up at the Lawrence Hall of Science in the Berkeley Hills. I had to ask his name a second time because I didn't catch it the first time. Another reminder of my feeble attention and wandering mind. After a few laps, Dwight remarked about the cloudless blue sky. I had been so lost in thought I hadn't even noticed the sky. Then he headed for the hills. He was a marathon runner. And I returned home, thinking about my mind. A self-defeating activity, if ever there was one. I observed that in the gym I kept my attention focused precisely on every action. But when I stopped soaring, my thoughts would again obscure my perception. That night, I walked to the station early, hoping to greet Socrates at the beginning of his shift. By now, I'd done my best to forget about yesterday's incident in the library and was ready to hear any antidote to my hyperactive mind that Sock cared to suggest. I waited. Midnight arrived. Soon after, so did Socrates. Sock put the tea kettle on, and I began, as was my custom, with a question. Socrates, how do I stop my thoughts, my mind, other than by developing a sense of humor? First, you need to understand where your thoughts come from, Dan, how they arise in the first place. When the mind resists life, thoughts arise. When something happens to conflict with a belief, turmoil is set up. Thought is an unconscious reaction to life. A car rolled into the station bearing a formally dressed older couple who sat like ramrods in the front seat. Come with me, Sock ordered. He removed his windbreaker and his cotton sport shirt, revealing a bare chest and shoulders with lean, well-defined muscles. He walked up to the driver's side of the car and smiled at the shocked pair. What can I do for you folks? Gasoline to fuel your spirits? Perhaps oil to smooth out the rough spots in your day? How about a new battery to put a little charge in your life? He winked at them openly and stood his ground, smiling as the car lurched forward and sped away from the station. He scratched his head. Maybe they just remembered that they left the water running at home. While we relaxed in the office, sipping our tea, Socrates explained his lesson. You saw that man and woman resist what to them represented an abnormal situation. Conditioned by their values and fears, they haven't learned to cope with spontaneity. I could have been the highlight of their day. You see, Dan, when you resist what happens, your mind begins to race. The same thoughts that impinge upon you were actually created by you. And your mind works differently, I asked. My mind is like a pond without ripples. Your mind, on the other hand, is full of waves because you feel separated from, and often threatened by, an unplanned, unwelcome occurrence. Your mind is like a pond into which has been dropped a boulder. As I listened, I gazed into the depths of my teacup when I felt a touch just behind my ears. Suddenly my attention intensified. I stared deeper and deeper into the cup, down, down. I was underwater. Looking up. This was ridiculous. Had I fallen into my own teacup? I had fins and gills. Very fishy. I whipped my tail and darted to the bottom, where it was silent and peaceful. Suddenly, a huge rock crashed into the water's surface. Shock waves slapped me backwards. My fins whipped the water again, and I took off, seeking shelter. I hid until everything quieted down again. As time passed, I became accustomed to the little stones that sometimes fell into the water, making ripples. The large plunks, however, still startled me. In a world filled with sound and dryness again, I lay on the couch, looking up, wide-eyed, at Sock's smile. You were a very nervous fish, fleeing from every large ripple. Later you became used to the ripples, but still had no insight into their cause. You can see, he continued, that a magnificent leap of awareness is required for the fish to extend its vision beyond the water in which it is immersed to the source of the ripples. A similar leap of awareness will be required of you. When you understand the source clearly, you'll see that the ripples of your mind have nothing to do with you. You'll just watch them, without attachment, no longer compelled to overreact every time a pebble drops. You will be free of the world's turbulence as you calm your thoughts. Remember, when you are troubled, let go of your thoughts and deal with your mind. Socrates, how? A not-so-bad question, he exclaimed. As you've learned from your physical training, leaps of gymnastics, or of awareness, don't happen all at once. They require time and practice. And the practice of insight into the source of your own ripples is called meditation. With that grand announcement, he excused himself and went to the bathroom. Now it was time to spring my surprise on him. I yelled from the couch so he could hear me through the bathroom door. I'm one step ahead of you, Socrates. I joined a meditation group a week ago. I thought I'd do something myself about this old mind of mine, I explained. We sit together for half an hour each evening. I'm already starting to relax more and get some control over my thoughts. Have you noticed I've been calmer? Say, Sock, do you practice meditation? If not, I can show you what I've learned. The bathroom door blasted open just then, and Socrates came straight at me, screaming a blood-curdling shriek, holding a gleaming samurai sword over his head. Before I could move, the sword slashed at me, cutting silently through the air and stopped inches over my head. I looked up at the hovering sword, then at Socrates. He grinned at me. Oh, you sure know how to make an entrance. You scared the crap out of me, I gasped. The blade ascended slowly. Poised over my head, it seemed to capture and intensify all the light in the room. It shone in my eyes and made me squint. I decided to shut up. But Socrates only knelt on the floor in front of me, gently placed the sword between us, closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and sat perfectly still. I watched him for a while, wondering if this sleeping tiger would awaken and leap at me if I moved. 10 minutes passed, then 20. I started to fidget and got up quietly to get a drink of water. I was filling my mug when he put his hand on my shoulder. Water sloshed over my shoes as my hand jerked. "Socrates, I wish you wouldn't sneak up on me like that. Couldn't you make some noise?" He smiled and spoke. "Silence is the warrior's art, and meditation is his sword. It is the central weapon you'll use to cut through your illusions. But the sword's usefulness depends upon the swordsman. You don't yet know how to use the weapon, so it can become a dangerous, deluding, or useless tool in your hands. The warrior, on the other hand, uses the sword with skill and deep understanding, slashing through thoughts to reveal their lack of substance. What you need to stay on the right track, then, is a special map that covers the entire terrain you will explore. Step into the office, and I'll give you just the map you need." We entered through the garage door. I plopped onto the couch. Socrates settled without a sound between the massive armrests of his plush chair. He stared at me for a full minute. "Uh-oh," I said nervously under my breath. "Something's up." "The problem is," he sighed at last, "that I can't describe the terrain for you, at least not in so many words." He rose and walked toward me with that shine in his eye that told me to pack my suitcases. I was going on a trip. For an instant, from a vantage point somewhere in space, I felt myself expanding at the speed of light, ballooning, exploding to the outermost limits of existence, until I was the universe. Nothing separate remained. I had become everything. I was consciousness, recognizing itself. I was the pure light that physicists equate with all matter, that poets define as love. I was one, and I was all, outshining all the worlds. In that moment, the eternal, the unknowable had been revealed to me as an indescribable certainty. In a flash, I was back in my mortal form, floating among the stars. I saw a prism shaped like a human heart, which dwarfed every galaxy. It diffracted the light of consciousness into an explosion of radiant colors, sparkling splinters of every rainbow hue, spreading throughout the cosmos. My own body became a radiant prism then, throwing splinters of multicolored light everywhere. And it came to me that the highest purpose of the human body is to become a clear channel for this light, so that its brightness can dissolve all obstructions, all knots, all resistance. I felt the light diffracted across the systems of my own body. Then I knew that awareness is how the human being experiences the light of consciousness. I learned the meaning of attention. It is the intentional channeling of awareness. I felt my body again as a hollow vessel. I looked at my legs. They filled up with warm, radiant light, disappearing into brightness. I looked at my arms, with the same result. I focused attention on every part of the body until I became wholly light once again. Finally, I realized the process of real meditation. To expand awareness, to direct attention, to ultimately surrender to the light of consciousness itself. A light flickered in the darkness. I awoke to Socrates shining a flashlight back and forth across my eyes. "Power failure," he said, baring his teeth like a Halloween pumpkin, as he held the light up to his face. "Well, is it all a bit clearer now?" he asked, as if I had just learned how a light bulb worked, rather than seen the soul of the universe. I could hardly speak. "You see," he said lightly, "these little journeys do save some difficult explanations I must go through to enlighten you." Just then the lights flashed on, and we both laughed. He reached into a small refrigerator next to the water cooler and brought out some oranges, which he started to squeeze into orange juice as he continued. "If you must know, you're doing me a service, too. I'm also stuck in a place in time and space, and owe a kind of debt myself. A lot of me is tied up with your progress. In order to teach you, he said, tossing the orange rinds back over his shoulder into the wastebasket, making a perfect shot every time. I literally had to put a part of me in you. Quite an investment, I assure you. So it's a team effort all the way. He finished making the juice and handed me a small glassful. A toast, then, I said, to a successful partnership. Done, he smiled. Tell me more about this debt. To whom do you owe it? Oh, let's say it's just part of the house rules. That's silly. That's no answer at all. Silly it may be, but still, I must abide by a particular set of rules in my business. He took out a small business card. It looked normal enough until I noticed a faint glow. In embossed letters it said, Warrior Incorporated, Socrates, Proprietor, specializing in paradox, humor, and change. Keep it safe, he said. It may come in handy. When you need me, when you really need me, just hold the card in both hands and call. I'll be there, one way or the other. I put the card carefully in my wallet. I'll keep it safe, Socrates. You can count on it. By the way, you wouldn't have one of those cards with Joy's address on it, would you? He ignored me. We were silent then, as Socrates began to prepare one of his crisp salads. Then I thought of another question. Socrates, how do I do it? How do I open myself to the light of awareness? Well, he asked, answering a question with a question, what do you do when you want to see? I laughed. I look. Oh, you mean meditation, don't you? Yep, he answered. And here's the core of it, he said, as he finished cutting the vegetables. There are two simultaneous processes. One is insight, the willing of attention, the channeling of awareness to focus precisely on what you want to see. The other process is surrender, letting go of all arising thoughts. That is real meditation. That is how you cut free of the mind. We ate. I stabbed at my vegetables with a fork. He picked up each small bite with wooden chopsticks, breathing quietly as he chewed. He never picked up another bite until he was completely done with the first, as if each bite was a small meal in itself. I kind of admired the way he ate as I chomped merrily away. I finished first, sat back, and announced, I guess I'm ready to have a go at real meditation. Ah, yes, he put down his chopsticks, conquering the mind. If only you were interested. I am interested. I want self-awareness. That's why I'm here. You want self-image, not self-awareness. You're here because you have no better alternatives. Because your deepest craving is survival. You want forever. You desire eternity. In your deluded belief that you are this mind or spirit or soul, you find the escape clause in your contract with mortality. Perhaps as mind you can wing free of the body when it dies, hmm? It's a thought, I grinned. That's exactly what it is, Dan, a thought, no more real than the shadow of a shadow. Consciousness is not in the body. Rather, the body is in consciousness. And you are that consciousness, not the phantom mind which troubles you so. You are the body, but you are everything else too. That is what your vision revealed to you. Only the mind is deluded, threatened by change. So if you will just relax mindlessly into the body, immortality is already yours, but not in the way you imagine or hope for. You have been immortal since before you were born and will be long after the body dissolves. The body is consciousness. It is immortal. It only changes. The mind, your own personal beliefs and history and identity, is the only mortal. So who needs it? Socrates signed off by relaxing into his chair. If I'm not my thoughts, what am I? He looked at me as if he'd just finished explaining that one and one are two, and then I'd asked, Yes, but what are one and one? He reached over to the refrigerator, grasped an onion, and shoved it into my hand. Peel it, layer by layer, he demanded. I started peeling. What do you find? Well, another layer. Continue. I peeled off a few more layers. Just more layers, Sock. Continue peeling until there are no more layers. What do you find? Well, there's nothing left. There is something left, all right. What's that? The universe. Consider that as you walk home. I looked out the window. It was almost dawn. I came in the next night, after a mediocre meditation session, still brimming with thoughts. There wasn't much early evening business, so we sat back sipping peppermint tea and I told him about my lackluster meditation practice. "Yes, your attention is still diffused. Let me tell you another story." A Zen student asked his Roshi the most important element of Zen. The Roshi replied, "Attention." "Yes, thank you," the student replied, "but can you tell me the second most important element?" And the Roshi replied, "Attention." Puzzled, I looked up at Sok, waiting for more. "That's all, folks," he said. I stood up to get some water, and Socrates asked me, "Are you paying close attention to your standing?" Yes, I answered, not at all sure that I was. I walked over to the dispenser. "Are you paying close attention to your walking?" he asked. "Yes, I am," I answered, starting to catch on to the game. "Are you paying close attention to how you talk?" "Well, I guess so," I said, listening to my voice. I was getting flustered. "Are you paying attention to how you think?" he asked. "Socrates, give me a break. I'm doing the best I can." He leaned toward me. "Your best is not good enough. The intensity of your attention must burn. Aimlessly rolling around a gym mat doesn't develop a champion. Sitting with your eyes closed and letting your attention roam doesn't train your awareness." "But why should a warrior sit around meditating?" I asked. "I thought this was a way of action." "Meditation is the action of inaction. Yet you are quite correct that the warrior's way is more dynamic. Ultimately, you will learn to meditate your every action. Yet at the beginning, sitting meditation serves as a ceremony, a special time set aside to increase the intensity of practice. You must master the ritual before you can expand it properly into daily life. As a teacher, I will use every method and artifice in my command to get you interested and to help you persevere with the work ahead. If I had just walked up to you and told you the secret of happiness, you would not have heard me. You needed a guy to fascinate you, do a soft shoe, or jump up on rooftops before you could get a little interested. Well, I'm willing to play games, for a little while at least, but there comes a time when every warrior must walk the path alone. For now, I'll do what is necessary to keep you here, learning this way." I felt manipulated and angry. "So I can grow old sitting in this gas station like you, waiting to pounce on innocent students?" I regretted my remark as soon as it slipped out. Socrates, unfazed, smiled and spoke softly. "Don't mistake this place or your teacher, Dan. Things and people are not always as they seem. I am defined by the universe, not by this station. As to why you should stay, what you can gain, isn't it obvious? I am completely happy, you see. Are you?" A car pulled in just then, clouds of steam surrounding its radiator. "Come," Sok said. "This car is suffering, and we may have to put it out of its misery." We both went out to the stricken car, whose radiator was boiling and whose owner was in a foul mood, fuming. "What took you so long? I can't wait around here all night, damn it!" Socrates looked at him with nothing less than loving compassion. "Let's see if we can help you, sir, and make this only a minor inconvenience." He had the man drive into the garage, where he put a pressure cap on the radiator and found the leak. Within a few minutes he'd welded the hole shut, but told the man that he would still need a new radiator in the near future. "Everything dies and changes, even radiators," he winked at me. As the man drove away, the truth of Sok's words sank in. He really was completely happy. Nothing seemed to affect his happy mood. In all the time I'd known him, he had acted angry, sad, gentle, tough, humorous, and even concerned. But always, happiness had twinkled in his eyes, even when tears welled up in them. I thought of Socrates as I walked home, my shadow growing and shrinking as I passed under each street light. I kicked a stone into the darkness as I neared my apartment, walking softly down the driveway to the back, where my little converted garage apartment waited under the branches of a walnut tree. It was only a few hours away from dawn. I lay in bed, but couldn't sleep. I wondered whether I could discover his secret of happiness. It seemed even more important right now than jumping up onto rooftops. Then I remembered the card he had given me. Quickly, I got out of bed and turned on the light. Reaching into my wallet, I extracted the card. My heart started to beat rapidly. Socrates had said that if I ever really needed him, to hold the card in both hands and just call. Well, I was going to test him. I stood for a moment, trembling. My knees were starting to shake. I took the softly glowing card in both hands and called, "Socrates, come in, Socrates, Dan calling." I felt like a complete fool standing there at 4:55 in the morning, holding a glowing card, talking to the air. Nothing happened. I tossed the card carelessly onto the dresser in disappointment. That's when the lights went out. "What?" I yelled as I spun around, trying to sense if he was there. In classic movie style, I took a step backwards, tripped over my chair, bounced off the edge of the bed, and sprawled on the floor. The lights went back on. If someone had been within earshot, that person might have assumed I was a student having trouble with ancient Greek studies. Why else would I be yelling at 5:02 in the morning, "God damn it, Socrates!" I'd never know whether the blackout had been a coincidence or not. Socrates had only said he'd come. He hadn't said how. I sheepishly picked up the card to put it back in my wallet, when I noticed it had changed. Underneath the last lines, paradox, humor, and change, appeared two words in bold print, emergencies only. Laughing, I fell asleep in no time at all. Summer workouts had begun. It was good to see old familiar faces. Herb was growing a beard. Rick and Sid were cultivating their dark summer tans and looked slimmer and stronger than ever. I wanted so much to share my life and the lessons I'd been learning with my teammates, but I just didn't know where to begin. Then I remembered Sock's business card. Before warm-up began, I called Rick over. "Hey, I want to show you something." Once he saw that glowing card in Sock's specialties, I knew he'd want to know more about it. Maybe they all would. After a dramatic pause, I pulled the card out and flipped it over to him. "Take a look at this. Pretty strange, huh? That guy's a teacher of mine." Rick looked down at the card, turned it over, then looked back up at me, his face blank as the card. "Is this a joke, Dan? I don't get it." I looked at the card, then turned it over. I grunted, stuffing the piece of paper back into my wallet. "Just a mistake, Rick. Let's warm up." I sighed inwardly. Socrates, I thought, what a cheap trick, disappearing ink. That night I had the card in my hand when I walked into the office. I threw it down on the desk. "I wish you'd quit playing practical jokes, Socrates. I'm tired of looking like an idiot." He looked at me sympathetically. "Oh? Have you been looking like an idiot again?" "Socrates, come on. I'm asking you, will you please quit it?" "Quit what?" "The gag with the disappear..." Out of the corner of my eye, I caught a soft glow from the vicinity of the desk. The card stood face up, saying, "Warrior Incorporated, Socrates, proprietor, specializing in paradox, humor, and change. Emergencies only." "I don't get it," I murmured. "Does this card change?" "Everything changes," he replied. "Yes, I know, but does it disappear and appear again?" "Everything disappears and appears again." "Socrates, when I showed it to Rick, there was nothing there." "It's the house rules," he shrugged, smiling. "You're not being particularly helpful. I want to know how..." "Let it go," he said. "Let it go." Summer passed quickly, with intensive workouts and late nights with Socrates. We spent half the time practicing meditation and the other half working in the garage or just relaxing over tea. At times like these, I would ask about Joy. I longed to see her again. Socrates would tell me nothing. With vacation's end imminent, my mind drifted back to the coming classes. I was walking down Telegraph Avenue to do some shopping and had just come out of the pharmacy with toothpaste when a scrawny teenager came up to me, so close I could smell stale alcohol and sweat. "Spare some change, can't you?" he asked, not looking at me. "No, sorry," I said, not feeling sorry at all. As I walked away, I thought, get a job. Then vague guilt came into my mind. I'd said no to a penniless beggar. Angry thoughts arose. He shouldn't walk up to people like that. I was halfway down the block before I realized all the mental noise I had tuned into and the tension it was causing, just because some guy had asked me for money and I'd said no. In that instant, I let it go. Feeling lighter, I took a deep breath, shook off the tension, and turned my attention to the beautiful day. That night at the station, I told Socrates my news. "Sock, I'm flying down to L.A. in a few days to visit my folks. I'm going to buy a motorcycle while I'm down there. And I just learned this afternoon that the United States Gymnastics Federation is flying Sid and me to Ljubljana, Yugoslavia, the World Gymnastics Championships." To my surprise, Socrates just frowned, saying, "What will be, will be." I chose to ignore this and started out the door. "Well, bye for now, Sock. See you in a few weeks." "I'll see you in a few hours," he responded. Meet me at Ludwig's Fountain at noon. Okay, I answered, wondering what was up. Then I said goodnight. I got 6 hours sleep and ran to the fountain just outside the Student Union. Ludwig's Fountain was named after a dog who used to frequent the spot. Several other dogs were romping and splashing there, cooling off from the August heat. A few little kids were wading in the shallow water. Just as the campanile, Berkeley's famous bell tower, began to chime the noon hour, I saw Sock's shadow at my feet. I was still a little sleepy. "Let's walk," he said. We strolled up through campus, past Sproul Hall, beyond the optometry school and Cowell Hospital, up beyond the football stadium into the hills of Strawberry Canyon. Finally, he spoke. "For you, Dan, a conscious process of transformation has begun. It cannot be reversed. There's no going back. To try and do so would end in madness. You can only go forward now. You're committed." "Ah, you mean like in an institution?" I tried to joke. He grinned. "There are similarities." We walked silently then, in the shade of the overgrown bushes along the running path. "No one can help you beyond a certain point, Dan. I'll be guiding you for a while, but then even I must stand back, and you will be alone. You'll be tested severely before you're done. You'll have to develop great inner strength. I only hope it comes in time." The mild bay breeze had stopped and the air was hot. Still, I felt a chill. Shivering in the heat, I watched a lizard scurrying through the underbrush. Sock's last words had just registered. I glanced over at him. He was gone. Frightened, not knowing why, I hurried down the path. I didn't know it then, but my preparation had ended. My training was about to begin. And it was to begin with an ordeal I almost didn't survive. Chapter 4. The Sword is Sharpened. After storing the Valiant in a rented garage, I boarded the F bus to San Francisco, connecting with airport transit, which got caught in a traffic jam. It looked as if I'd be late for my flight. Anxious thoughts began to arise. I felt my belly tense. Then, as soon as I noticed it, I let it all go as I'd been trained. I relaxed and enjoyed the scenery along Bayshore Freeway, reflecting on my growing mastery over stressful thoughts, which had habitually plagued me in the past. And, as it turned out, I caught my plane with seconds to spare. Dad, an older version of me with thinning hair, wearing a bright blue sports shirt over his muscular chest, met me at the airport with a strong handshake and warm smile. Mom's face crinkled sweetly as she greeted me at the door of their apartment. All the while I'd been tempted to tell them about my adventures with Socrates, but thought better of silence. Perhaps I'd explain it all in writing some day. I spent most of my time in Los Angeles looking for a motorcycle and finally found a 500cc Triumph. It took me a few days to get comfortable with it, and I almost fell twice, each time thinking I'd seen joy coming out of a store or disappearing around a corner. My final day in Los Angeles soon arrived. Early the next morning, I'd zoom up the coast to Berkeley, meet Sid that evening, and we'd take off for Yugoslavia and the World Gymnastics Championships. I relaxed around the house during the day. After dinner, I took crash helmet in hand and left the house to shop for a traveling bag. As I walked out the door, I heard Dad say, "Be careful, Dan. Motorcycles are hard to see at night." His usual caution. "Yeah, Dad, I'll be careful," I yelled back. Then I gunned the bike and pulled out into the traffic. I roared through the dusk. The streetlights flashed by as I approached 7th and Western. I was about to cut through the intersection when I noticed a red and white Buick facing me, signaling for a left turn. I slowed down, a small precaution which probably saved my life. Just as my bike entered the intersection, the Buick suddenly accelerated, turning directly in front of me. For a few more precious seconds, the body I was born with was still in one piece. There was time enough to think, but not to act. "Cut left," my mind screamed, but there was oncoming traffic. "Swerve right." I'd never clear the fender. "Lay it down." I'd slide under the wheels. My options were gone. I slammed on the brakes and waited. It was unreal, like a dream, until I saw a flashing image of the driver's horrified face. With a terrible thud and the musical sound of tinkling glass, my bike smashed into the car's front fender and my right leg shattered. Then everything sped up horribly as the world turned black. I must have lost and regained consciousness just after my body somersaulted over the car and crashed onto the concrete. A moment of blessed numbness, then the pain began, like a searing, red-hot vice, squeezing and crushing my leg tighter and tighter, until it became more than I could bear, and I started to scream. I wanted it to stop. I prayed for unconsciousness. Faraway voices. Just didn't see him. Parents' phone number? Take it easy. They'll be here soon. Then I heard a faraway siren, and hands were removing my helmet, lifting me onto a stretcher. I looked down and saw a white bone sticking out through the torn leather of my boot. With the slam of the ambulance door, I suddenly remembered Socrates' words, "And you'll be tested severely before you're done." Seconds later, it seemed, I was lying on the X-ray table in the emergency room of Los Angeles Orthopedic Hospital. The doctor complained of fatigue. My parents rushed into the room, looking very old and very pale. That's when reality caught up with me. Numb and in shock, I started to cry. The doctor worked efficiently, anesthetizing me, snapping my dislocated toes back into place, and sewing up my right foot. Later in the operating room, his scalpel sliced a long, red line deep into my skin, cutting through the muscles that had worked for me so well. He removed bone from my pelvis and grafted it to the fragments of my right thigh bone. Finally, he hammered a narrow metal rod down the center of my bone, from the hip, a kind of internal cast. I was semi-conscious for 3 days in a drug sleep that barely separated me from the agonizing, unrelenting pain. Sometime in the evening of the third day I awoke in darkness, when I sensed someone quiet as a shadow sitting nearby. Joy got up and knelt by my bedside, stroking my forehead as I turned away in shame. She whispered to me, "I came as soon as I heard." I wished for her to share my victories, but she always saw me in defeat. I bit my lip and tasted tears again. Joy gently turned my face to hers and looked into my eyes. "Socrates has a message for you, Danny. He asked me to tell you this story." I closed my eyes and listened intently. An old man and his son worked a small farm with only one horse to pull the plow. One day the horse ran away. How terrible, sympathized the neighbors. What bad luck. "Who knows whether it's bad luck or good luck," the farmer replied. A week later the horse returned from the mountains, leading 5 wild mares into the barn. "What wonderful luck," said the neighbors. "Good luck? Bad luck? Who knows?" answered the old man. The next day the son, trying to tame one of the wild horses, fell and broke his leg. "How terrible! What bad luck!" "Good luck? Bad luck?" said the farmer. The army came to all the farms then to take the young men for war. The farmer's son, because of his broken leg, was of no use to them, so he was spared. "Good? Bad?" I smiled sadly as Joy finished the story, then bit my lip again as I was assaulted by a wave of pain. Joy soothed me with her voice. "There are no accidents, Danny. Everything is a lesson. Everything has a purpose. A purpose. A purpose," she repeated, whispering in my ear. "But my gymnastics, my training, it's over." "This is your training. The pain can purify the mind and body. It burns out many obstructions." She saw the questioning look in my eyes and added, "A warrior doesn't seek pain, but if pain comes, he uses it. Now rest, Danny, rest." She slipped out behind the entering nurse. "Don't go, Joy," I muttered, and fell into a deep sleep, remembering nothing more. Friends visited, and my parents came every day. But for most of 21 endless days I lay alone, flat on my back, watching the white ceiling, meditating for hours, battered by thoughts of melancholy, self-pity, and futile hope. On a Tuesday morning, leaning on new crutches, I stepped out into the bright September sunlight and hobbled slowly to my parents' car. I had lost almost 30 pounds, and my pants hung loosely on my protruding hip bones. My right leg looked like a stick with a long purple scar down the side. I stayed with my parents for a few days, resting in the hot sun and swimming slowly through the shallow end of the swimming pool, painfully forcing my sutured leg muscles to work. I ate sparingly, fruits and vegetables, nuts, a little yogurt. I was beginning to regain my vitality. Friends invited me to stay with them for a few weeks at their home in Santa Monica, 5 blocks from the beach. I accepted, welcoming the chance to spend more time in the open air. Each morning I walked slowly to the warm sand and, laying my crutches down, sat by the waves. I listened to the gulls in the surf, then closed my eyes and meditated for hours, oblivious to the world around me. Berkeley, Socrates, and my past seemed lost in another dimension. Soon I began to exercise, slowly at first, then more intensely, until I was spending hours each day sweating in the hot sun, doing push-ups, sit-ups, curls. I carefully pressed up to handstands, then pumped up and down, again and again, puffing with exertion until every muscle had worked to its limit and my body glistened. Then I would hop one-legged into the shallow surf and sit dreaming of lofty somersaults until the salt water washed my shining sweat and soaring dreams into the sea. I had time, to consider all that had happened to me since I had met Socrates. I thought about life and its purpose, death and its mystery, and I remembered my mysterious teacher, his words, his animated expressions. Mostly, though, I remembered his laughter. The warmth of the October sun faded into the November clouds. Fewer people came to the beach, and during this time of solitude, I enjoyed a peace I had not felt for many years. I imagined staying on the beach my whole life, but I knew I'd be going back to school after Christmas. My doctor gave me the results of my x-rays. "Your leg is healing well, Mr. Millman, unusually well, I should say. But I caution you, don't get your hopes up. The nature of your accident doesn't make it likely that you'll be able to do gymnastics again." I said nothing. Soon I waved goodbye to my parents and boarded a jet. It was time to return to Berkeley. Rick picked me up at the airport. I stayed with him and Sid for a few days, until I found a studio in an old apartment house near campus. Each morning, gripping my crutches tightly, I'd make my way to the gym and train on the weight machines, then fall exhausted into the swimming pool. There, assisted by the water's buoyancy, I'd force my leg to the point of pain, trying to walk, always, always to the point of pain. Afterwards, I would lie on the lawn, behind the gym, stretching my muscles to retain the suppleness I'd need for future training. Finally, I rested, reading in the library until I fell into a light sleep. I had called Socrates to tell him I was back. He wasn't much for talking on the phone and told me to visit him when I could walk without crutches. That was fine with me. I wasn't ready to see him yet. It was a lonely Christmas that year until Pat and Dennis, two of my teammates, knocked on my apartment door, grabbing me, grabbed my jacket, and practically carried me to the car. We drove toward Reno, up into the snow, and stopped at Donner Summit. While Pat and Dennis ran through the snow, wrestling, throwing snowballs, and sledding down the hill, I hobbled carefully through the snow and ice and sat on a log. My thoughts floated back to the coming semester and to the gymnastics room. I wondered if my leg would ever heal straight and strong. Snow dropped from a branch, thudding with a slushy sound to the frozen ground, waking me from my reverie. Soon we were driving home. Pat and Dennis were singing bawdy songs. I watched white crystals float down around us, glittering in our car's lights as the sun began to set. I thought about my derailed future and wished that I could leave my whirling mind behind me, buried in a white grave beside the road in the snowy mountains. Just after Christmas, I made a brief visit to L.A. to see my doctor, who let me trade in my crutches for a shiny black cane. Then I headed back to school and to Socrates. It was Wednesday night at 11:40 p.m. when I limped through the doorway of the office and saw Sock's radiant face. I was home again. I'd almost forgotten what it was like to sit and sip tea with Socrates in the quiet of the night. It was a more subtle and in many ways greater pleasure than all my athletic victories. I looked at this man who had become my teacher and saw things I'd never seen before. In the past I had noticed a light that seemed to encircle him, but I'd assumed it was only my tired eyes. I wasn't tired now, and there was no doubt about it. It was a barely perceptible aura. "Socrates," I said, "there's a light shining around your body. Where does it come from?" "Clean living," he grinned. Then the bell clanged, and he went out to make someone laugh under the pretext of servicing a car. Socrates dispensed more than gasoline. Maybe it was that aura, that energy or emotion. Anyway, people nearly always left happier than when they'd arrived. It wasn't the glowing, however, that impressed me most about him. It was his simplicity, his economy of motion and of action. I hadn't truly appreciated any of this before. It was as if I saw more deeply into Socrates with every new lesson I learned. As I came to see the complexities of my mind, I realized how he had already transcended his. When he returned to the office, I asked, "Socrates, where is Joy now? Will I see her again soon?" He smiled as if glad to hear my questions again. "I don't know where she is. That girl is a mystery to me. Always was." I then told Socrates about the accident and its aftermath. He listened quietly and intently, nodding his head. "Dan, you're no longer the young fool who walked into this office over a year ago." "Has it been a year? It seemed like 10," I joked. "Are you saying I'm no longer a fool?" "No, only that you're no longer young. Hey, that's real heartwarming, Soc. But now you're a fool with spirit, Dan, and that's a very big difference. You still have a faint chance of finding the gate and passing through." "Gate?" I said. "The gate exists inside you, and you alone must find it. I can only guide you. But you're not ready yet, not nearly ready. If you attempted to pass the gate now, it would mean your almost certain death. There's much work to be done before you're prepared to knock at the gate. To find the gate, you must first learn to follow the house rules," I volunteered. He laughed. Then the bell clanged as a car pulled smoothly through a rain puddle into the station. I watched through the misty window as Socrates walked quickly out into the drizzle, wearing his poncho. I could see him put the gas nozzle in, go around to the driver's side, and say something to a bearded, blond-haired man in the car. The window misted over again, so I wiped it clean with my sleeve in time to see them laughing. Then Socrates opened the door to the office, and a draft of cold air slapped me harshly, bringing with it my first awareness that I didn't